This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Hoosier History. From local history journals and books from across the Hoosier State, you'll learn the stories of the people and events that have shaped our present. For the next 60 minutes, it's Hoosier History, right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome to Hoosier History. I'm your host, Mary Seeberger, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I'll start today with On This Day in Indianapolis History. This is a compilation by Dawn E. Backen and was published in 2016. May 6, 1950. Political infighting can produce odd results. In the 1950 primary elections for Indianapolis city government, the reigning faction of the Democratic Party lost several offices to its inter-party challengers. The city administration had been turning a blind eye to large-scale gambling in the city for years, but the other Democratic faction had received large amounts of funding for its primary campaigns from the gambling interests. Thus, the city police were sent out in early May to put a, quote, glove-tight crackdown, unquote, on all organized gambling within the city limits. The results, reported by the Indianapolis Star, were temporarily impressive. Orders were given to operators of the some two dozen horse race bookie parlors in the city to remove all telephones and other equipment. It was as hard to find a slot machine within the city limits last night as it is to hit a jackpot. Big-time gamblers were making speedy preparations to move their illicit businesses into outlying areas of Marion County to escape the shutdown. A well-known casino at 4444 West Washington Street, outside the city limits, was reported expanding to handle the increased trade. On this day in Indianapolis, May 6, 1950, returning to the thoughts of Ernie Pyle, this is Images of Brown County. A few little sketches of Brown County people. One night, I met Billy Pryor, a young man in his last year of high school. His father is a rural mail carrier. They live several miles out of town, way up a hollow, at the end of the dirt road. Billy was walking home, so I drove him instead. He is tall and thin and smiling, and I saw that in him was a sensitiveness that is unusual in boys his age. I could feel that he appreciates his hills and their nature and their peoples even more, probably, than most of the artists. As we drove along, I said, "What is the name of this hollow?" "It doesn't have any," he said, "except that I call it Pleasant Valley and sometimes Happy Valley." It was gathering dusk. The dark green ridges stood up on either side of us, and you could barely make out cabins. The names Billy used were commonplace, but there was a deep intensity in his voice. "You really love it that much?" I asked him. "Oh, yes, I really do," he said. That's all we said about it. But it almost made a lump in my throat that anyone so young and unstudied could feel so passionately for his own soil and valleys and trees. John Dine came into Dennis Calvin's hardware store while I was there. He was in overalls. He lives way up Salt Creek and does some farming. He is, furthermore, one of the half dozen men in Brown County who pans occasionally for gold. In many ways, John Dine represents the true native character of Brown County. He has bought his own clothes since he was 7 years old by panning gold. For 51 years, he has dressed himself with his gold pan. He is slow-spoken, polite, and in him there is a strong pride in being independent. He says he knows how to do lots of things besides farming. A fellow has to live down here. "I never could stand to see somebody do something I couldn't do," he says. There is not a real living in gold in these hilly creeks, but it forms an alternate when everything else fails. When times are bad or the crops too poor, John Dine takes to the creek with his whole family. He has never been on relief. "I've never worked for the WPA," he said. "Never before had I heard it expressed that way." Anybody else would have said, "I've never been on..." There's a difference. And that difference forms a little shading of pride and an old-fashioned independence. John Dine took out of his pocket a little glass bottle with a screw top with some gold flakes in the bottom of it. John Dine wanted $2 for it. Dennis Calvin paid him $2. They didn't weigh it or haggle about it or anything. John said it was worth $2. So Dennis knew it was worth $2. That's the way things are here. In politics, Brown County is rock-ribbed Democratic. It is so Democratic that although the courthouse is nearly three-quarters of a century old, today's county auditor, Grant Rogers, is the first Republican who ever held office in it. In fact, Rogers says that during his first few days in office, people passing in the corridor would stop and stare at him through the door, marveling at this awful outrage they had perpetrated upon themselves by their own voting. Virgil Lee Gardner walked up to me one evening. He was a sad, serious-faced little boy in overalls who seemed to have the weight of the world on his shoulders. I forget what he asked me first, but I was buying an Indianapolis Times at the moment, and it turned out he was the Times boy in Nashville. He said he had 36 regular customers in Nashville. He said if he could get up to a total of 50, he would get a three-day vacation trip to Dune State Park up on Lake Michigan. He said another boy got that many and then quit as soon as he got his vacation trip. He said he didn't think that was any way for a boy to do business. He also said that now and then the Times made a mistake and sent him too many papers, and that when they did, he took those extra copies around and gave them away to people. That seemed like good business to him. I've never seen a tycoon more grave. And so, not just because I write for the paper, but in spite of it, I would like to suggest that it is a civic duty of the people of Nashville, Indiana, to subscribe for 14 more Indianapolis Times on behalf of a certain local businessman whose initials are VLG. This is Ernie Pyle's writings, August 19th, 1940. The winter 2024 edition of Traces of Indiana and Midwestern History from the Indiana Historical Society, entire issue is Hoosiers and the Vietnam War. I'll now read the last article in this edition. Bloods, an oral history of the Vietnam War by Black veterans. This is by Ray E. Boomhauer. Wallace H. Terry Jr., who served as deputy bureau chief for Time magazine in Saigon, had amassed an impressive record as a journalist. Hired by the Washington Post at just 19 years old, he'd been one of the few black reporters assigned by a mainstream daily newspaper to chronicle the civil rights movement in the South. He was there for the critical March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom and heard Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s stirring "I Have a Dream" oration. It seemed as though the impossible could happen, King's dream of one day in Georgia having the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners being able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. Could it be a reality? Those magnificent dreams of brotherhood, however, had been bathed time and time again in blood. Terry had to endure such tragic deaths as Medgar Evers, a National Association for the Advancement of Colored People official, gunned down in the driveway of his Jackson, Mississippi home, by Byron Della Beckwith, a member of Jackson's White Citizens Council on June 12, 1963. Shortly before Medgar Evers' death, Terry had visited him at his home, where the civil rights leader had treated the threats on his life as a badge of honor. "This is what you must face to get free in Mississippi," he explained to the reporter, who had watched as a car driven by two white men attempted to run Evers down in front of the city's NAACP headquarters. While covering demonstrations in Birmingham, Alabama, Terry himself barely escaped with his life when the hotel he had been staying at had been bombed by segregationists. The worst was yet to come. April 4, 1968, his friend and his eldest son's godfather, Martin Luther King, had been shot and killed by an assassin in Memphis, Tennessee, where King had gone to support striking black sanitation workers. Terry heard the news about King's death while on leave in Singapore, where he had made a home with his wife Janice and their children. Terry had gone to get a haircut only to discover his Chinese barber crying. When he asked him what was wrong, the barber said his tears were for King, whose life had ended too soon. "And I thought, even a Chinese barber in Singapore." "And I began to cry too," Terry recalled. When, he wondered, might God decide to lower the curtain for good on his life? Rockets and mortars fired by forces of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, commonly known as the Viet Cong, shattered Saigon's quiet on May 5th, leading Terry to believe that a new offensive against the South Vietnamese government and its American allies was at hand. This attack would later be known as the second phase of the Tet Offensive that had first been launched against targets throughout South Vietnam by the Viet Cong and the People's Army of Vietnam on January 30th. He huddled with his time colleague John Cantwell, an Australian who spoke Chinese and loved Asia. Terry remembered that Cantwell often played a whistle for the birds he kept at the villa, the magazine used for its headquarters, hoping they would answer with their songs. The two men had grown close while working together. Terry recalled that one night at the Embassy Hotel, where they lived, they went up to its roof with a bag of hamburgers and watched while rockets and flares lit up the city. "We decide this is one war we don't want to lose our lives in," Terry said. "For both of us, Vietnam is making less sense each day." To cover the renewed fighting, one of the Time newsmen had to attend a military briefing while the other investigated the damage inflicted on Saigon by the enemy. When Terry told Cantwell to attend the briefing while he roamed the city, the Australian demurred, insisting that his friend should stay with Janice, who might be frightened by the renewed violence. Terry agreed, but warned his friend to avoid such particularly hazardous areas as Tan Son Nhut Airport and Cholan, Saigon's Chinese sector. Before Cantwell set out, other reporters, Frank Palmos, a fellow Australian, Bruce Pidgett and Ronald Laramie from the Reuters News Service, and Michael Birch of Australian Associated Press, asked him if they could ride along. Cantwell agreed, and the reporters drove away in a mini-moke, a small open-top utility vehicle. Unfortunately, Cantwell ignored Terry's advice. Chasing after two U.S. helicopter gunships attacking an enemy force, he drove into Cholan, ignoring warnings from South Vietnamese civilians that enemy forces were in the area. Three armed men appeared from behind an oil drum as the journalists drove down a dirt road. Although the reporters had continually called out, "Bao Chi, press, press," Viet Cong opened fire at point-blank range with rifles and an AK-47 automatic weapon. "He seemed to enjoy his work," Palmos said of the insurgent who finished off the wounded reporters with his pistol. Not only did he ignore all pleas of innocence, killing Westerners seemed to appeal to him. "Some honor for him. No possible response for us." He had, in his mind, killed five Western enemies. Palmos pretended to be dead and waited until the gunmen had to reload their weapons to sprint away, using the other Viet Cong for cover. "I was absolutely bloody shaken," he recalled. "I could hardly hold a notebook." Commandeering a three-wheel pushcart, Palmos went about a mile until he came upon an Australian soldier who rode shotgun with him until they made it to safety with U.S. military police. Terry remembered Palmos staggering into Time's villa, visibly shaken, his clothes torn, and crying out that his companions had been killed. Terry knew that he had to risk his own life to learn what had happened to Cantwell. I let him go there, he remembered. If he's alive or dead or captured, I have to know. I owe him that. Zaylin Zip Grant, a former U.S. Army intelligence officer in Vietnam, who had worked with Terry in Time's Washington, D.C. bureau, and had returned to the war zone as a correspondent for New Republic magazine, agreed to help. Grant had been skeptical about Palmos' report, believing there was a chance some of the reporters had survived the attack. Was he really sure the newsmen were all dead? Grant wondered about Palmos. How about if one or two were only wounded and lying in Chalon bleeding to death as we spoke? Terry and Grant decided to go it alone, embarking on a perilous and frustrating journey to discover their colleague's fate. Finally, with the assistance of American forces, they had pushed into the area and came upon the site where Cantwell had stopped his vehicle. They were all dead. "I am too overwhelmed to cry," Terry said. "Laramie is sitting up in the mini moke, his arms still upraised. The others are on the ground, their bodies full of holes. Caked in blood, covered in flies, bloated from the heat. John had been shot 12 times. When an ambulance driver refused to help transport the bodies, Terry and Grant stacked the dead journalists in the back seat of their vehicle, another mini moke, as quickly as possible, realizing the Viet Cong might return at any moment. And they did. A group of 30 Vietnamese wearing black pajamas ran by the duo, holding their fire, but looking at the Americans with hatred on their faces. "Why don't they kill us? Perhaps it is their rush to get out of the area," reflected Terry. The only thing he could find on his friend's body was the whistle Cantwell used to entice the villa's birds to sing. Returning to his hotel, Terry gave the whistle to his wife and told her Cantwell had died. "We cry together," Terry said. Walking into a press briefing the next day, he was surprised to see newsmen start to clap. Terry looked around to see who might be behind him, but there was no one. "The applause is for me and for Zip, and I will always feel for our comrades who died doing their job," he recalled. The ghastly experience did have a positive outcome. It resulted in a lifelong friendship between Grant and Terry. The men found what many soldiers in Vietnam, black and white, had shared while serving together. Terry recalled, "A bonding took place as much for us as it did for the soldiers who risked their lives to pull comrades out of the line of fire or out of burning helicopters." The determination displayed by Terry in tracking down and recovering his comrades' bodies had been a part of his character from the beginning of his journalism career, which included groundbreaking positions at his Indianapolis high school and college newspapers. His trailblazing in the profession continued at Time, where he became the first black correspondent working for a U.S. news magazine. It was an important event for black people to make this kind of breakthrough on the color line, he noted. "I was becoming a national correspondent, the first among black people to represent the mainstream media." Upon his return from Vietnam, Terry needed all the resolve he could muster to bring to life his dream of writing a book that would draw people's attention to the sacrifices made by black soldiers during the war. He wanted his book to topple the conviction that, quote, "white soldiers are invincible, black soldiers are invisible," unquote. The book grew to become an absolute crusade, Terry remembered. Beyond telling the stories of the often forgotten black Vietnam veterans and the racism they faced while overseas and at home, Terry wanted to write about the conflict because, to him, there existed no greater subject to write about than war, because it's the worst thing that we do to each other. Almost all the human emotions are involved in war. It is the most desperate time for man. Terry believed that war often brought out the worst in men, but also sometimes their best, especially compassion and love for each other regardless of skin color, a camaraderie forged in battle. "That is the lasting message, the only positive message about Vietnam," he said. "The rest of it is nonsense, foolishness." Terry found it ironic that the closest America came to the kind of society King had dreamed about came during the middle of a war he hated. The newsman knew, however, the damage war did to a person's soul. You are taking a descent into hell when you enter war. Terry faced a host of challenges during the more than a decade it took him to get his book published, including dealing with the appalling memories of his time in combat. He remembered the pools of blood sloshing around his Mini Moke from the bodies of the reporters crammed onto its rear seat, accompanying troops on dangerous night ambushes, having a soldier's leg come off when he grabbed it while trying to drag the wounded man to safety during a firefight. "I would sleep with the TV on and guns by my bed and under it," Terry recalled about his return home. "I'd take sleeping pills, but I still couldn't sleep more than 4 hours." Publishers told him there was only a limited market for books about blacks written by blacks. "I didn't want to give up," he said, "but I couldn't see the light of day." After numerous rejections, Terry's dream came true when Random House in 1984 released his book, Bloods, an Oral History of the Vietnam War by Black Veterans. It became a bestseller and today is considered a classic reflection on a war that divided U.S. society and cost approximately 58,000 Americans their lives. As Janice, who worked closely with her husband on the book, noted, its publication opened the gates to knowledge about black servicemen and their service and their bravery and their commitment to America. As for Terry, he hoped that Bloods would appeal to all races, believing that when a white man saw himself in the experience of a black man, then I had done what I had always wanted to do as a journalist. He especially wanted Americans to know there was nothing about the black experience that was not universal and human. If we understand that, we can live with each other in a much better way. The book's power has not diminished over time. For his 2020 film, Defive Bloods, about five African-American Vietnam War vets, renowned director Spike Lee, who read every book and watched every documentary he could find about the war, had been especially impressed by Terry's book that he assigned its reading to the film actors, which included Delroy Lindo, Jonathan Majors, Clark Peters, and Chadwick Boseman. Born on April 21, 1938 in New York City, Terry was raised in Indianapolis by his mother Nancy and stepfather Frederick G. Schatz, whose interracial marriage had shocked both the black and white communities in the city. She was black, he was white. The manager of the Personal Art Screen Process Printing Company, Schatz encouraged the young Terry's early interest in journalism. "As far back as grade school, I was editor of something," he recalled. His stepfather also urged him to rise above the racism he faced in Indiana's capital city, where African Americans could not sit down and eat with white customers in local restaurants, register as guests in a downtown hotel, or swim in the public pools. If he had the money to see a movie, Terry had to sit in a segregated seating area in the theater's balcony. While attending a prestigious local private school for a short time, he remembered that he and other students, after reciting the Pledge of Allegiance, had to sing Dixie. A classmate asked him why black people wanted to be slaves. "No one was teaching anyone anything about black history or the black experience," he added. Schatz's untimely death from a heart attack at age 43 stunned his stepson. "He had become my mentor," Terry told a reporter years later about Schatz. "He was helping me figure out what to do with my life. I never replaced him." Terry attended Shortridge, the state's oldest free public high school, and known for its dedicated staff and its students' academic prowess, especially when it came to writing skills. Located at 34th and Meridian Streets, the school sponsored the country's first daily high school newspaper, the Shortridge Daily Echo, whose former staff members included such notable writers as Kurt Vonnegut Jr. and Dan Wakefield. Although weighing only 105 pounds upon entering the ninth grade, Terry played on the school's freshman football team, suffering a broken wrist during a game. An English teacher suggested that it might be safer for everyone if Terry wrote about sports instead of trying to play them. He became the first black editor of the paper, working on its Tuesday edition. Each summer, his parents helped him sharpen his skills by encouraging him to attend high school journalism institutes, including one at Butler College, today Butler University, Franklin College, Northwestern University, and IU, where he pointed out the journalism building was named in honor of famed Hoosier World War II columnist Ernie Pyle. "That was one of the influences on me in wanting to be a war correspondent one day," said Terry. "I thought there was no one like Ernie Pyle except maybe Ernest Hemingway and Stephen Crane. Those writers had the greatest influence on my own writing." Terry graduated from Shortridge in 1955, racking up an impressive list of achievements that a local black newspaper, the Indianapolis Recorder, made sure to document for its readers. His many accomplishments included being the first black to win the Indianapolis News's Merle Sidner Award for Journalism at Shortridge, the first to be named Secretary General of the Marion County Mock High School United Nations, the first to attend Northwestern's High School Journalism Institute, and the first to win an award while attending the institute. Terry decided, however, to pass on an offer to attend Northwestern, wanting instead to go to the best small college that I could get into and study the classics. Applying to several institutions, he picked Brown University, an Ivy League institution in Providence, Rhode Island, attending thanks to a U.S. Navy Reserve Officer Training Corps scholarship. "My family did not have the money to send me to college, which meant I had to go where I could get the best financial aid," he said. Brown, too, had a daily paper, the Brown Daily Herald, and full of myself as I was going to show them a thing or two. Visiting the Daily Herald's offices during its freshman recruitment period, Terry announced to the newspaper staff that he would one day be its editor. Reflecting on his boldness, he said it delayed his admission to the newspaper staff. "I had to heal longer than anyone in history just to cool me down," said Terry, who eventually became a reporter. The summer after his freshman year, he freelanced articles for the Indianapolis News, producing a series of articles relating to his experiences on a two-month training cruise as a U.S. Navy midshipman aboard the battleship USS New Jersey. For his second summer at the newspaper, he carried coffee to publisher Eugene C. Pulliam's office and wrote obituaries. He recalled that for many years he kept a photocopy of the first check he received from the News. Terry's belief in his abilities, however, paid off when he took advantage of a constitutional crisis about school desegregation to achieve a scoop that landed him on the front pages of newspapers across the country. September 2, 1957, Arkansas Governor Orville E. Faubus had called out his state's National Guard to block admission of 9 black students to Central High School in Little Rock, defying the U.S. Supreme Court's historic ruling in 1954's Brown versus the Board of Education, that segregated public schools were unconstitutional. To resolve the state-federal standoff, Faubus traveled to Rhode Island in mid-September to meet with President Dwight D. Eisenhower at a U.S. naval base in Newport. Seeing an opportunity for a scoop, Terry tracked down the governor at his hotel in Providence. Borrowing a white jacket to pose as a hotel waiter, the college journalist made it past guards to Faubus's room and knocked. Congressman Brooks Hayes opened the door and asked why I had come to see Governor Faubus. Terry remembered, "I told him that I felt the students of this nation should know about the situation in Little Rock in detail, since it was they who were directly affected." Although Faubus declined to be interviewed at the time, he did talk to Terry and other representatives from Brown the next day. An enterprising wire service photographer captured a smiling Faubus shaking hands with Terry. The photograph appeared in the New York Daily News under a headline reading, "Negro Reporter Gets a Fair Shake from Faubus," as well as on page one of the country's leading newspaper, the New York Times. According to Terry, his stepfather joked with him, "You've landed on the front page of the New York Times. You're going to spend the rest of your life trying to get there again." And he was right. The next year, Terry won election as the Daily Herald's editor-in-chief, becoming the first Black to serve in the post at Brown and in the Ivy League. Before his senior year, he worked at the Washington Post, where he was treated like a regular reporter and paid union scale. That was phenomenal because I was only 19 when they offered me the job. After graduating from Brown in 1959 with Phi Beta Kappa honors, Terry received a Rockefeller Theological Fellowship to the University of Chicago and became an ordained minister with the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. He missed journalism, however, and sought a part-time job in the field. "No one around Chicago would hire me because I was Black," Terry reported. "I didn't want to work for the Black press because I saw it as specialized. I believed I should work in the mainstream media. While I was interested in stories that related to Blacks, I thought those stories also related to whites. They were American stories." He received pointed advice from Fletcher Martin, a Chicago Sun-Times reporter, and the first Black to win a prestigious Nieman Fellowship at Harvard, an honor Terry later received. Learning that Terry had worked the previous summer for the Post, Martin told him, "Son, it took me 20 years to get where you got, before you even got out of college. You don't need to talk to me. You need to go back to the Washington Post." Martin called Al Friendly, the Post's managing editor, asking him to hire Terry, and Friendly did. After about a year with the paper, Terry became deeply involved in covering the civil rights movement. "To me, it was the biggest story in the country. It was a story that I passionately cared for because it was going to affect me, my family, children, and generations of Black people to come," he noted. He did a series of articles about the Nation of Islam, interacting with a charismatic minister named Malcolm X, as well as writing about protest marches in the South. Terry continued to cover the struggle for civil rights after moving from the Post to Time magazine, at the time the country's top news magazine. He had been drawn to joining its staff by the large number of overseas correspondents it employed. Although his editors told him he would not be pigeonholed into Black reporting, Terry demurred. After all, he had latched onto the Bear as the best way to get off-night rewrite at the Post. "I was damn sure going to get out of being a catch-all junior member of the Washington Bureau for Time," he recalled. Making the civil rights movement his focus gave Terry the opportunity to work on several cover stories for the magazine, including profiles of such leaders as Martin Luther King and reports from the scenes of major riots in Watts, Harlem, Detroit, and Newark. "He got injured in New York. A brick got thrown off a roof into his chest," remembered Janice. "It wasn't directed at him. He just happened to be in the way of the brick being thrown off the roof." The couple had met at Howard University party in 1960 and married a few years later. At the party, Terry had proposed to Janice just minutes after meeting her, captivated that she knew his name from his byline. She later acknowledged, "I'm the type of person who reads everything. I read the back of cereal boxes." He didn't know that. Terry had an opportunity for an overseas assignment in early 1967 when he suggested that the magazine do a cover article about Black soldiers fighting in Vietnam. Richard Clurman, Time's chief of correspondence, called Terry to ask him to fly to Vietnam to help with the story. Terry accepted the assignment, believing that the attention President Lyndon Johnson had given to civil rights and his Great Society programs had been overtaken by a fixation about Vietnam. The war was destroying the bright promises for social and economic change in the Black community, he said. "I was losing a great story on the home front to a greater story on the battlefront." The piece, which ran in the magazine's May 26, 1967 issue, pointed out that for the first time in the country's history, Black soldiers were fully integrated into combat, fruitfully employed in positions of leadership, fiercely proud of their performance. It seemed as if the U.S. military stood as a shining example when it came to race relations. "It was our first fully integrated war," Terry observed. "It was democracy in a foxhole, the same mud, the same blood." While Black-white relations were, in a slit trench or a combat-bound Huey, years ahead of many communities in the U.S., The article noted there were problems with racist graffiti from both sides emblazoned on the walls of latrines in Saigon and fights while off duty. But as a black infantry officer told Terry, with all the inadequacies and imperfections, the United States still offers more individual rights than any other country. It is still worth dying for. Impressed by Terry's work, Klerman asked him to return to Vietnam for a 2-year stint in Time's Saigon Bureau, working as its deputy chief. Terry quickly accepted the assignment as Vietnam represented the biggest story in the world, and also in the back of my mind, I thought that I would write a book. The correspondent's 2 years overseas became the most exhilarating and exciting years of his life. Maybe I got a rush from the danger and from the excitement. Terry said years after his overseas assignment ended, I went to where the action was because I felt that's the only way I could fully tell the story. He knew he could be killed accompanying troops on dangerous search and destroy missions in the jungle or flying with pilots as they bombed enemy targets. Even reportedly safe rides on a U.S. helicopter could be dangerous, as they could fall from the sky due to mechanical failures or by a single bullet from a Viet Cong soldier. Simple meals or drinks in Saigon could be deadly if the restaurant had been targeted by bombers. Once I got into an area even in the rear, if you're there overnight, you're subject to enemy rocket and mortar fire. He pointed out, not to mention snipers and booby traps and landmines. During his time in Vietnam, Terry said he encountered a couple of touchy situations where there was a prospect that we would be overrun, and I was handed a weapon by my escorts, and even told that if I didn't want to be taken by the enemy, I should use a grenade on myself. I don't know if I'd ever do something like that, but there were indications that we were really in deep water. He never fired a weapon, believing that his job involved watching what the soldiers were doing and trying to keep a balanced head, be alert, keep myself alive, and pick up the flavor of what is happening. Janice often shared the dangers with her husband on her 18 trips to Vietnam, staying for 3 or 4 days at a time and visiting major U.S. installations at Da Nang and Chu Lai. She remembered that her husband thought it was important for soldiers to see a female civilian. I felt extremely honored to be there to give them a moment of peace, to take their minds off the war, said Janice. Both black and white soldiers treated her with great respect, almost as if royalty was there. Terry described her as soul sister number one. She remembered an occasion when a white soldier asked her if she would like some potato chips. When Janice assented, he returned, bringing with him enough potato chips to feed an entire outfit. Terry learned that racial relations among American troops in Vietnam had deteriorated from the hopeful story Time had published just a year before. After traveling all over the country, from the Demilitarized Zone to the Mekong Delta, interviewing American forces, Terry saw that the gung-ho professional soldiers who had volunteered for service early in the war had been superseded by draftees who were much more cynical. Replacing the careerists with black draftees, many just steps removed from marching in the civil rights movement or rioting in the rebellions that swept the urban ghettos from Harlem to Watts, Terry observed, all were filled with a new sense of black pride and purpose. These soldiers who called themselves Bloods and lionized Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, and Huey Newton were more willing to question the American presence in the war. As his Time article, Black Power in Vietnam, pointed out, there were more incitements from white soldiers, including Confederate flags displayed on trucks and barracks, cross burnings, and Ku Klux Klan costumes. In response, said Terry, African American troops raised their fists in Black Power salutes, had their handshakes, flew red, black, and green liberation colors in battle, and protected each other against racism. He realized that the spirit of foxhole brotherhood he had seen in 1967 had vanished. Terry set out to use information he had gleaned in notebooks and tape cassettes to produce a book about the war, leaving his job at Time to do so. During his last few months in Vietnam, the magazine had agreed to let him go into the field to conduct research he could potentially use for his book. "I ended up surveying hundreds of soldiers," he said. "I asked them social and political questions, how they felt the war was progressing. Were we doing it the right way? Should we invade the North? What they thought of draft card burners and the anti-war movement. What they thought of each other and the Vietnamese. Were blacks being discriminated against?" As he sorted through the material and wrote, Terry supported his family by serving as a consultant to the U.S. Air Force, teaching journalism at Howard, and working for an advertising agency. "When the book came out," Terry recalled, "I thought I would have an enormous degree of leverage as a journalist. I thought I would be able to call my own shots." Terry wrote his more than 600-page manuscript as both a narrative and oral history, almost a series of one-act plays or like a film script, doing so because he wanted to protect GIs still in the service whose fiery comments might get them in trouble with military authorities. Terry could not find a publisher. Many of them rejected his manuscript because he recalled them telling him Americans did not want to hear any more about Vietnam. They most certainly do not want to hear anything connected to blacks who were in Vietnam. It became so bad that his children would go to bed at night praying, "Dear God, please let my daddy find a publisher because he's driving us crazy." Terry remembered, "My wife suggested I publish the rejection notices as a book. She figured I had enough." Terry's son David recalled that some of his earliest memories were the sights and sounds of the war. The family's home in Washington, D.C. became like a safe house for black veterans who wanted and needed to share their stories, as they were, as David remembered, people whose lives had been damaged and destroyed by their time in Vietnam. One of the men interviewed, Army veteran Richard J. Ford III, confessed to Terry, "I really feel used. I feel manipulated, violated." Unburdening themselves to his father, David pointed out, became part of the black soldiers' healing process. Janice, who taught first grade and worked at other jobs as well, sought relief from the accumulated stress through reading, which had always been her resource for peace and learning, and neighborhood walks. She also sought relief by visiting the gardens at the nearby Washington National Cathedral. "Somehow the spirits guided me there," she remembered. Terry persisted. Finally, in 1982, Random House expressed interest in his work. Errol MacDonald, an editor at the publisher, suggested that instead of a narrative, the book should be done as an oral history. Author and broadcaster Stutz Terkel had experienced great success with his oral history collections, including Hard Times, an oral history of the Great Depression, and Working, People Talk About What They Do All Day and How They Feel About What They Do. Although he respected Stutz Terkel's work, Terry wanted to do something distinctly different and innovative. Remembering a short story class he took at Brown University, Terry decided to use some of those techniques for his book, which he called an oral novella. "I decided I didn't want to use a question and answer format. I didn't want to get in the way of the narratives," he recalled. Essentially, the book would be a series of short stories placed in a progression that would give the impact and effect of reading a novel. Each of the pieces included in Bloods had a beginning, middle, and end, plus flash forwards and flashbacks. I wanted each story to have a hook. When you started reading, I wanted you to feel like you couldn't put it down once you were inside the first three or four paragraphs, he said. Terry also thought that on every page, the reader should be moved to laugh or cry or to feel that you'd gotten some information you never had before. There had to be something memorable on each page. If that wasn't there, I felt I'd failed. MacDonald had some helpful advice for Terry, telling him to make sure that each of the voices sounded grammatically different, or else they would read like New York Times articles. Incorporating this technique, Terry believed, gave an originality to each voice. "Since I didn't physically describe these people or describe them in any other way either, they're telling their own stories through me." From a list of 50 possible subjects, he featured 20 in Bloods, with the common thread among them being they were black veterans talking about what they had faced during the war and after. I sought a representative cross-section of the Black Combat Force. Enlisted men, non-commissioned officers, and commissioned officers, noted Terry. Soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. Those with urban backgrounds and those from rural areas. Those for whom the war had a devastating impact. Those for whom the war basically was an opportunity to advance in a career dedicated to protecting American interests. Janice believed it was sort of like talking to your therapist. She told a reporter with The Ringer, they knew Wally and they trusted him, and that's how they opened up so easily for him. The secret in being a good oral historian, Terry pointed out, involved gaining the confidence of his subjects and asking the right questions. Remember, you're talking to people about their innermost lives. Often you're asking them to describe things that they've been trying to forget or actions they've committed they're not especially proud of. Bloods achieved for Terry what he had set out to accomplish, eventually serving as the basis for a program by the PBS television series Frontline and adapted for the National Public Radio program, All Things Considered. What touched Terry the most, however, was the reaction to his book from Vietnam veterans. One black soldier I talked to called me Blood. He said I'd become one of them. For several years after the book's release, he kept the story alive by traveling around the country, talking to high school and college students in a program that involved from a lecture or reading into more of a one-man show or a one-man play. Terry often bristled about the depiction of blacks in such well-known films as Oliver Stone's Platoon, Full Metal Jacket, and Born on the 4th of July. Hollywood had the chance to write the big lie about black soldiers, but it only succeeded in perpetuating it. Platoon shows black as lazy, implying that they have to be pushed to fight or that they lack leadership ability, he explained in an interview with People magazine. That is contrary to the war I covered for 2 years and have studied and written about for 20 years. It's a slap in the face. Terry died on May 29, 2003, from a rare, undiagnosed vascular disease. Janice noted that he had been plagued with a persistent cough that resisted treatment. One day at noon, when I arrived to take him to a scheduled appointment with his doctor, he suddenly collapsed as he was putting on his coat, she remembered. An ambulance quickly took him to the nearest hospital, where he was immediately put on a respirator and sedated into a medically induced coma. He never came out of the coma. Before his death, Terry had been deep into a planned 2-volume work about African-American journalists, eventually published in 2007 as Missing Pages, Black Journalists of Modern America, an Oral History. The book featured black correspondents from World War II, the Civil Rights Movement, and the Vietnam War. He hoped his book might fill a hole in the history of journalism for college courses, but also be of interest to general readers who would like to hear about major events in American history as seen through the eyes of a special breed of professional observers. The shadow of the Vietnam War continued to loom large in Terry's life. He compared the conflict to the U.S. Civil War, seeing it as a subject Americans would go back to and back to and back to. We'll never get away from it. It was a war he believed could not be romanticized, seeing it as too ambiguous. But we'll be writing about it forever, and the best books, the best films are probably yet to come. The author, Ray E. Boomhauer, is senior editor at the Indiana Historical Society Press. He has written numerous articles for Traces. And now the magnificent 92 Indiana courthouses. This was photographed by Will Counts. The text is by John Diltz. Let's go to Decatur, Indiana, which is Adams County. The Adams County Courthouse was designed by J.C. Johnson, a self-taught architect who had been trained as a carpenter and a joiner. Yet he was a gifted designer and won second place in the competition to design the Indiana State Capitol. Adams County was the home of the writer and naturalist Jean Stratton Porter, whose Girl of the Limberlost, written in 1909, was a longtime Hoosier bestseller. The Limberlost was a swampy, wild place, and it figured also in a court story about a bailiff who was sent out to find a witness. To get the witness was a matter of urgency because the jurors had already been selected and were waiting. The out-of-town lawyers were restless and becoming a nuisance, and the judge was cranky. Armed with his warrant, the bailiff rode out after the witness, only to return the next day dirty and tired. He had chased the witness into the Limberlost and returned, of course, empty-handed. His warrant properly noted the justification for this failure, an excuse recognized by the Adams Circuit Court. The witness was perceivable but not gettable. The courthouse was built between 1872 and 73. The cost was $78,979. In 1990, when this book was published, the population was around 31,000. Next, let's go as far northwest as we can, Crown Point in Lake County. The old courthouse in Lake County has been preserved as a national treasure and has been a registered national landmark since 1973. Although county business is no longer conducted in this building, but rather at a large government complex on the city's north side, it is the old building that speaks with romantic elegance of the life and style of local government. After all, this was the place where silent film star Rudolph Valentino got his marriage license back in 1923. The architecture is eclectic and original. John C. Cochran used elements of Victorian, Romanesque, and Georgian styles, but overall it has an academic flavor. Additions were made in 1907 and 1928. Cochran's only other courthouse in Indiana is the one in Valparaiso. In 1971, the county built Lake County Government Complex on a 70-acre tract. Those three buildings are steel and glass and house a jail, courts, and administrative offices. Crown Point's original courthouse was extensively rebuilt after a disastrous fire in 1934. Other examples of Cochran courthouses from the same period can be found in Illinois, Missouri, and Iowa. I've been reading from The Magnificent 92, Indiana Courthouses, and this was published in 1991. Well, that is all the time I have for today. This has been Mary Seeberger with Hoosier History. I hope you enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library, right here in Fort Wayne, Indiana.